Next Thing You Know. It's a podcast about how our lives go exactly not as we planned them. I'm Susie Sherman. I want to welcome you to this first episode of the podcast. I'm really excited to share these stories with you about how our missteps and mistakes and disappointments and serendipity lead us not away from our life plans, but in fact become the plan. It's slipping on the proverbial banana peel as we glide into a beautiful surrender to the flow of our lives. Sometimes it's graceful, most times it's really fucking messy. Today, I'm talking with my guest, Becca, about creative actualization, how our drives for self-expression and creativity get derailed, whether by internal narratives or structural oppression or the demands of making our work marketable. And yes, marketable was just said in air quotes. And this conversation is about how we keep on creating, even if that looks like playing the piano for no one but ourselves. I wanted to start with this episode because while my conversation with Becca isn't about a precise moment when everything suddenly changed for her, it is illustrative of how our lives are an ongoing creative process. And that's inspiring for me, and I think it'll be inspiring for you. And it touches in on the zeitgeist of this podcast. This is my conversation with Becca.
And then I had a press pass for another show that last year that I was actually really, really excited about, and it turned out to be, it was white guys being kind of casually racist, profoundly disappointing because the work that I had seen online was so smart, but off the cuff when they weren't editing and didn't have a peer review, I guess, before they put stuff online, they'd probably have people look at it. It was kind of a hot mess.
Yeah, that sounds really shitty.
And that was so, I was kind of devastated by that.
Well, there's a lot of rude awakenings being around.
Yeah.
Industry, kind of the way industry runs in that
yeah.
way.
Yeah, and the thing is, I kind of expect this from most stand-up comedians, on some metric, unless they have every metric of oppression then if it, on their personal docket of experience, right?
Right.
Right.
Comedy is often the realm of folks can hide racism, sexism, everything, homophobia, etc. Against that sort of backdrop of I'm making commentary on it, or that's my job as a comedian to point things out. And it's actually you have to think through the implications of this and actually evaluate whether what you're saying is even fucking funny.
Yeah.
Because you're saying a racist fucked up thing. It's not funny.
I mean, yeah. And the thing is the thing about humor is it always has a target. There's a punch. Humor, a joke is a punch.
Right.
And you can only punch in so many directions, right? You can punch in, you can punch up, you can punch down, you can punch out, and you can punch at a universally reviled group, right? There's always a joke is based on a set of shared assumptions. So, if somebody makes a joke, and the target is gay people or, gayness, then they're punching probably at, they're punching at the gay community, which is still a very vulnerable community, and especially for young people who are coming out. And if you're a famous person making that joke, a young person's going to hear that. And I think it's incumbent on all of us to think about our splash effects.
Yes.
That's the thing. Who is your joke punching at? Where is it okay to punch? It's always okay to punch up, right? We can punch up. But, we have to be careful. Because if your target is, say, Hillary Clinton, there are a lot of jokes you can make about Hillary Clinton that don't target her femaleness, right? Or her age.
Mm-hmm.
So you can make fun of Hillary Clinton, I think, with impunity for, say, her level of insular privilege that she's had for decades, right? Like, that's...
fair game.
Totally fair game. Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And you can make fun of her whiteness. Also fair game. But you can't make fun of her age. Not fair game, because that's punching down.
Especially with the intersection of
right.
being a woman.
Right? If you're 90, you can make fun of her age.
Yes!
But I think, like, I mean, I think you just have to look at where you sit. And, like, how do you sound? Like, can you, you know, if you're 90 years old, you can go up to somebody who's 70s, what, 70-something, right? And you can make fun of them for being 70. If you are 70, you can go up to someone who is your age and make fun of them for being 70. I cannot do that because I sound like a jerk, right? So it's just like when you punch down, like punching down is just it's a very low form of humor. It's
easy.
It's
very lazy.
Lacks imagination.
Yeah.
And mm-hmm. you get a laugh because, you know, like gay jokes, they read as funny to a lot of people because a lot of people are very uncomfortable about homosexuality at the same time that they want to be good liberals and support gay marriage. You know, that's not enough of a pro-gay position. You have to be pro, like, you know, if you're not...
You have to be full-on pro... messy butt sex.
Messy butt sex with hundreds of people in a week, if that's what somebody
that's
wants.
Right.
This is about body autonomy. How can you be pro-choice and not be in favor of somebody's right to fuck as many people in whatever way they want?
That's right.
It's the same philosophy, right? But people are duplicitous. We talked about that before.
Right. Well, let's back up
okay.
from butt sex. And hi, Becca.
Hey.
We haven't even said hi on mic yet.
Hi, Susie.
It's nice to see you. I'm so glad you're here.
Nice to see you, too.
I like talking about messy butt sex. And this is a fitting introduction right now.
It's like a glove.
Yeah, it really does. A well-lubed glove.
That's right.
And it's funny because to roll it back a little bit, the thing that we were sort of supposed to talk about before we got on that track was creative engagement in our lives.
Right.
Right. And so one of the things that came up at the top of this conversation here was your work doing writing. But
right.
I want to back up even a little further and ask you, how the fuck did you start professionally writing?
I don't think I professionally write. I've never made a dollar at writing. Let's get
okay.
that on the table real
well,
quick.
You've been published. You've been published.
I am trying to make a dollar at writing, mm-hmm. and I don't even know how to start that hustle. So I'm told that the first thing I need is a website. But no, I mean, I really like writing. I love music. I write to clarify my thoughts. You know, I think calling me a professional writer is a severe misnomer, and that's not about imposter syndrome. I really
that's
think
not
that,
about self-effacement.
No, I'm a solid writer. You know, I'm not an excellent writer.
You have writing skills.
I have writing skills. I have a command of the English language. I have a lot of complicated opinions, and I have the ability to express them. And I've practiced at that, but I mean, a professional writer I think of as somebody who does a lot more marketing than I've ever done, and that's a really, really scary thing to do.
Right.
And
it's a different skill set.
Yeah, it is absolutely. I was self-employed and I marketed the hell out of my services and made a living at that for a good number of years, and it was awful, and it wasn't even a creative endeavor. It was just like I was working with learning disabled children, and I was very good at remediating these specific problems because I had 1,000 hours of training in these particular methods. So of course I was good at it. I'd been taught to hell how to do it. But, you know, pitching and being rejected is, and like this whole morass of how to do that is just something I don't know how to enter that fray. And it's not about imposter syndrome. It's just about a sense of overwhelm.
Like being able to manage all the technical things that you need to do, or like all the tasks that you need to do to prepare manuscripts or market yourself, or
I think honestly it's just like it's like getting started on any open-ended task. It just, you look at the pile and you're like, is this the pile that I want to enter right now?
Mm-hmm.
And you go no.
Uh-huh,
until
uh-huh.
you say yes.
I love that idea. So like looking at this looming thing that might symbolize this huge change in your life, which would be like, my career is now being a writer, or
right. I mean, so I have like, so my, I mean, of course,
I'm not going to nail you down to like whatever your fantasy is about where your career path goes next or something like that. I know you're bit of a transitional moment in your life right now. I'm not trying to nail being a professional writer. I'm just that I love that image of like, this means this pile, this massive pile of tasks that I need to do is this like amorphous pile. It's not really specific steps that I need to do. And then beyond that, even if I were to like disambiguate the massive pile into these specific steps, do I want to go in the direction that those steps take me or not?
Yeah. I mean, these are hard questions. And, you know, there's... have you read Bird by Bird?
No.
It's such a great book. It's by Anne Lamott.
Mm-hmm.
And it's all about writing. And it's a beautifully written book about writing, mm-hmm. which is what you would hope, but you don't always get that, right?
Mm-hmm. There's so many books about writing, and I've read a few.
This one is... It's really beautiful. The title comes from a story from her childhood where her brother was struggling to write a report that he'd procrastinated on, and it was about birds, and he'd had weeks to do it, and it was the day before it was due, and he hadn't started, and her dad's sitting there with her brother, and her dad says, just bird by bird, little buddy. Just bird by bird.
And that was just a spontaneous
use
of language. That's so sweet.
It's really sweet.
Yeah.
But I don't know, you know, for me, you know, because I grew up in this really difficult family system, I had to really work on the idea that my creative endeavors were, like, important enough to do. You know, my dad certainly isn't one to sit there and like take an interest in somebody's art, you know, creative pursuit unless they're already at expert level, and kind, you know, like all these things that I didn't learn in childhood, like, oh, if you want to be good at something, you have to be bad at it for a long time.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
And like, also the idea that you can just do something because you love it and have no professional aspirations whatsoever, and that is still valid, right? Capitalism ruins everything.
That's right. That's right. And so, our culture is so set up in that way where we have this expectation that, like, if we're going to bother putting time and sweat equity and resources into developing a craft, that it should be profitable on the other side.
Right.
And obviously there's also tremendous privilege in being able to do something to free up time in your life, to do something at a hobby level and not expect to get income. So there's sort of a tension there as well, right? But I absolutely... I agree. I mean...
Yeah, I mean, it really bothers me so much that that's become a privilege, because it didn't used to be a privilege, right? We used to have time, because we used to, like, and I'm concerned that people don't think about this more. It used to be that, you know, you could be, say there was, like, a couple, you know, a domestic couple, any gender.
Sure, of course.
And... You know, one could sling coffee at a diner, and one could be a plumber, and they could live a nice, comfortable life with no, you know, no panic when rent was due.
Mm-hmm.
And they could even raise a child and go on the occasional vacation at that income level. And
right, cost of living was not nearly what it is.
Right. And, like, you know, they could have a car, and everything would be, like, you know, not they wouldn't be rich, but they certainly wouldn't be working 70 hours a week. And they would have time for their kid, and they would have time to maybe, you know, play a musical instrument. And the idea that having the time to do these things is now a privilege is, like, heartbreaking.
It always was, to some extent, developing skills or interest in the arts or something that's not going to be lucrative in and of itself, I think, always was to some degree a luxury. But the scale that we're talking about has really changed, right? And that I agree with you that probably working class folks had more of kind of a cultural and economic access to doing, you know, to developing skills to do stuff. But like, you know, but I think privilege always was a factor. I think the scale of things has really changed.
Right.
The cost of living is grossly disproportionately harder than it used to be.
Yeah, I mean, we can, like...
There were patrons of the arts, for example, if we're going back a couple hundred years, right?
Sure, I mean, we can get into a lot of different directions on this, but I feel like that's a transgression, but, you know, anyway.
We can go anywhere we want.
Right, yeah!
That's fine. I am more curious about your process, though.
My
right?
process. I mean, like I said to you, like, I really don't think that I'm a paragon of much of anything, but... Really, like,
welcome to my podcast, well, Becca, where none of us is a paragon of anything. And that's fine.
It's no.
That's okay. Like, we're real humans trying to get some creative meaning in our lives.
Right. So I don't do anything professionally as a creative. Right. I like to write, so I write, and I write for this blog that's run by, you know, people I know. Who I met through other people I know, and I just said I would like to do this, and they said sure. And I have a really hard time making the leap from private space to public exposure. And I'm sure that has a lot to do with my own like you know, you can call it a confidence gap, or you can call it imposter syndrome, or it doesn't matter what you call it, but I get a lot of analysis paralysis in whatever it is I'm working on, and have to take steps to circumvent it and keep it from weighing me down. So putting routines in place, you know, like every morning I take one of my dogs out for a walk, and then I go sit and write for 20 minutes in a cafe, and that kind of gets me started. And like some days I'm so focused on all of the tasks that I have to do that there's no ink in the creative well, so to speak. And other days it's great.
Mm-hmm.
But like,
you
have to show up.
Are you really disciplined about doing that 20 minutes of writing every morning, even if you're not feeling it?
No. Mm-hmm. But I still show up, and I have my pen and I have my notebook. Mm-hmm. And
you sit down with the intention to write, and sometimes you write, sometimes you don't.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I'm sure there are people who say that I'm doing it wrong.
Fuck Julia Cameron. No. She's very inspiring to a lot of people. She's very famous for The Artist's Way, so it's another book about writing.
Yeah, right.
And so she does morning pages, and that's super helpful for everyone.
That's
Julia,
cool.
I'm sorry I didn't mean to tell you to fuck off. That was
You can edit that out.
You know, it was a cultural moment that, you know, I took advantage of. It's fine. No.
She's listening right now.
Yeah, I'm sure. but yeah, I mean, some people really obviously like really are committed to doing that block of time every single day and developing that discipline. And I've had a lot of jealousy, you know, that people can develop that kind of discipline. I feel like there's a way in which I've held myself back in my creative aspirations because I've rigorously avoided rigor.
Right.
And so I've had some, maybe even some envy toward yeah. people who can do that. It's amazing. I don't think it's the only way to do it, and I'm definitely loosening up on myself and giving myself some more spaciousness to right. to create at a snail's pace, and that's okay. That's how it's played out
yeah.
in my own life.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I think the time aspect is really difficult, right? It's very hard to say, to like take the time out of. We're all supposed to be, you know, the narrative is we're all supposed to be overachieving all the time, right? And there's supposed to be some kind of opportunistic upside to everything that we do.
Mm-hmm.
And it took me like the more you think about that, the more you realize the extent to which it is true, right? Like, you're supposed to go out so you can meet people and network to get opportunities. Like, this is the capitalism narrative, right? So,
listening audience, you didn't see that Becca was using air quotes just then. Opportunities, quotes, for example.
Right.
Networking.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And, like, I really like this idea, and I don't remember the name of the artist who came up with the idea of decolonizing your time and your life and your brain. And, like, we can only decolonize to so much, right? Unless you're a subsistence farmer, and even then you have to own the land that you're farming on, right? So there's always a limit to how much you can disengage from...
Yes.
From whatever metric of oppression. And so if you can decolonize a part of your day every day just to pursue things that bring you joy, or the space for joy, or you know, like make your imagination spark, or whatever it is, and it's just yours and doesn't ride on anyone else's approval, That's pretty magical,
mm-hmm.
and it's really freeing, and the ripple effect of is that it can liberate other parts of you that are being held back. So, I find it to be incredibly transformative.
That's a beautiful concept. It's a really important concept.
I don't perform, you know. I've been playing piano now for 5 years. I have never had a public performance. I don't know how to do that. That's a different skill than playing piano. Mm-hmm. I don't know how to sit there and have an audience while I play, because I freeze. And mm-hmm. I haven't worked on that. And I may not, because this is a thing that I do because I love. I love music, and I love having the capacity to create these sounds and to interact with this instrument in a way. And so I'm starting to write songs, and I don't know if I'll ever perform them. I'd like mm-hmm. to think that eventually I will, but I also want that to not be the driving point, right? Like, it's each little...
It's not a goal-oriented process, it's a process-oriented process.
Right. Each little song, it's like when you start getting into these weeds, it's like it already kind of exists inside of you, and you're just taking this part of you and putting it into the shape of music.
That's so beautiful.
And but you have, like, there's this trust that you have to find to do it, and I personally struggle a lot with that, because it's you know, I'm literally a music critic for fun.
Right. So, you know the evils that are out there awaiting your public performance.
Well, it's not even that, but it's like I know what good music is. So when I make these little songs, they're not good, and I know they're not good, and that's really hard. But becoming a good songwriter means getting, you know, figuring out what to leave out and, like, how to assemble it, and it's just this messy process for a long time. You have to give yourself permission to suck at something. And that's part of, like, the, you know, decolonizing your brain a little bit, is, like, letting the ineptitude just sort of stand there on its own without being bad.
That's beautiful. That's so wonderful. I remember this takes me back to a memory from my college days, and there was a student art show that I was a part of, and you know, I didn't do visual art really. I did other stuff. I like played guitar and whatever. So people were doing different media, and someone had made a painting, and I was looking at the painting that was, you know, hanging up in this art show. And I looked at this painting and I was like, oh, that's such a shitty fucking painting. I didn't say it out loud, but I thought to myself, God, like, what, why put that up for people to see? It's awful. And then the next beat, I said to myself, oh my God, actually, it's amazing that this person is willing to put their shitty art out there, because they're doing their art for themselves and it's a meaningful process for them, and it doesn't matter that I think it's shitty. And it was a revelatory moment for me, and I think it took me really decades to come back to that idea for myself, to allow myself to lose that jaded critic positioning, and say, wow, like, I actually am really impressed with people who put out their work, whatever their work is and whatever quality their work is, because it's brave. It's fucking badass and brave to just put your shit out there into the world, especially if it's not totally polished and totally professional and totally beautiful and universally agreed that it's beautiful. And that in itself is so inspiring, when people are just willing to put themselves out there, warts and all, because we are so trained to have to be perfect and to, you know, not bother if you're not good enough. And we think, kind of going back to what you were saying earlier, hardly any of us gets that training that you have to suck for a really long time until you're good. And maybe you won't ever be good, and that's okay, because actually the process of creating is in and of itself what's most important.
Yeah, and the risk that it takes to put that out there is, like, you know, it's I don't do that, so because it's terrifying. And, you know, we do karaoke, mm-hmm. right? And karaoke has this great culture of it's about music fandom, essentially, right? We go up there and we sing these songs because we love them. And it's great if you can sing, and if you can't sing, you still belong there. Mm-hmm. There isn't anyone who's too bad at singing for karaoke. And that's one of the things that I really love about karaoke, is it's this permission to just celebrate in how much you love music.
Right. And that's not every karaoke community. I mean, I've been to karaoke bars where people get really nasty and catty about people who don't sing well. And I stay away from those places. I really like the community that you and I are in, you know, where I think there is that permission and that openness and that open-heartedness to people just expressing themselves.
Yeah. I went to a different karaoke night, and the people who could sing definitely got extra strokes from the KJ, and I'm like, that's kind of negative, you know? You know, like, I'm thinking to myself, like, hey...
Like, the KJ sort of publicly noticed people who were good singers,
yeah,
more than mediocre singers or whatever? Okay.
Mm-hmm. Right. Yeah, and, you know, like, I feel like the whole world is stacked in favor of people who have some kind of skill, right? Whatever it is, whatever the special, you know, skill is, the people who have those are going to get noticed more. And that's, you know, that's neither here nor there. But, like, I so love spaces where you don't get more attention for because you happen to have some kind of aptitude, right? Because you would score higher on some tests than the mean. And I think we're really short on those kinds of spaces, right? We need more places where we can just kind of, like, be clumsy for each other, you know? Like, where everyone's at amateur hour together.
Yeah.
If that makes sense.
Absolutely.
Right?
Do you... You know, the name of this podcast is And the Next Thing You Know,
and
right?
And the next thing you know.
And the overriding premise of it is, you know, was there a moment, what was there an experience, whether it was subtle, you know, almost not noteworthy, but it was noteworthy to you internally, it rearranged things internally, was there a moment that subtle or even a moment that was grandiose that sort of made you you know, that made you accept your flawedness, your imperfection more than you did before?
Oh my God.
Were there, or I'm assuming a set of experiences, but anything coming to mind around how that kind of tripped over to the other side for you, where
oh my God,
you were able to give yourself permission to be flawed?
Oh my God, this is a massive question. And I feel like I've been talking to my therapist about this all my life.
Yeah.
You know,
this is a lifelong process for us. This isn't something that probably ever resolves. But
it's so big, you know.
From where you're talking now, obviously you have more care toward yourself and more comfort with your imperfection than you used to, right?
I don't see them as imperfections, just because the idea of perfection is so absurd.
Yeah, I mean, use the language you want.
Yeah. I mean, like, it's not that I'm any closer to perfect than anybody else. I'm also not a narcissist, which I'm, like, I'm weirdly proud of not being a narcissist.
Yay! Clapping for you.
You know, but, like, I think we are in this weird, America's a very weird place. Humans are very strange creatures. And Americans like things to be very pat and very tidy, in a sense. You know, it's like, I'm very Jewish, as you know. My husband is very WASPy. Mm-hmm. Hi, Andy. And, you know, we talk, like, there's a very large culture gap between the two mm-hmm. of us, you know. And when I met my father-in-law for the first time, you know, there was a little bit of like, oh, well, you're different on both sides.
I'm so obviously, I don't mean to... name drop Woody Allen, but you have to think of the split screen in Annie Hall
all the time,
right?
All the time.
At dinner, where it's the goyim and the Jews at
all
dinner, like encountering
all
each
the
other.
Time. Yes. All the time.
Classic trope.
Yeah. That whole thing with Woody Allen just broke my heart, because I'm like, who do I identify with anymore? And then Rachel Bloom came along, and I'm like, all good.
Okay. Yes. You've got your neurotic Jew to
have you seen
to empathize
have
with.
You seen Crazy Ex-Girlfriend?
I've only seen a couple. Episodes.
I'm surprised. It seems like something you would like.
Probably. I'm just working on Supernatural right now, so, like, I'm just all about, you know, fucking 14 seasons of very hot guys killing monsters.
Respectable.
Yeah. It's where I'm at right now.
Yeah, so, like, you know, there is a certain thing in this WASPy culture that I observe with fascination. And it's sort of like, okay, is everything under control? Okay, everything's under control. We're good. And I'm like, what does this mean to you?
Right.
Nothing, literally nothing is under anyone's control at any given moment.
That's right.
There's no control. Let it go. You know, so I don't know. Like we've talked about a lot, I grew up in a very chaotic place. And so there was this big gap between, like, the story I was told about my upbringing by my parents and what actually happened. You know, I had to sit there and reconcile. I'm like, why are all of my very smart classmates, who are not smarter than me, in fact, all doing so much better in school than I am? Mm. And I went through the phase of believing, well, it must be because I am inherently bad. And this is a thing I believed mm-hmm. for a really long time. Mm-hmm. I'm like, okay, there must be something very, very wrong with me, because, you know, their parents feed them dinner and my parents don't feed me dinner, so that must be me. So Q had to, after many years of therapy, and I'm like, oh my God, that had nothing to do with me at all.
Right.
And that was a really, really big thing to learn. So,
well, and it's very much developmentally appropriate when you're very young to not understand, to kind of not have an awareness outside yourself enough to be able to say, this, actually, the adults are responsible for me.
Yeah.
I'm not, you know, this isn't my fault.
Right.
And that's something that, for sure, I have in my history around completely different things, too.
Yeah. And
but
I'm just gonna, like,
so it's a developmentally appropriate task for you later in life as an adult to be able to work work that through. And of course, it's hard to get over the concept of it.
I don't even think it's just developmentally, though. I think when you don't have agency at any age, right, and a lot of people don't have agency for a very long time for a variety of reasons. I mean, agency isn't something that you just sort of, one day you have it because, because you turn 18.
Right.
Right. You have to believe that you have agency.
Yes.
And women in particular are told all their lives, well, sweetheart, you're not really capable, or, you know, any other, like, thousands of other ways of framing
that.
So discovering that you have the agency to do the things for yourself that no one did for you that they were supposed to do, like meeting your base needs, is really tough. And if you don't have your basic needs, you're not going to learn how to play piano.
That's right.
Right. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I mean, I don't want to sit here and say that I was, like, sleeping out on the street, but, like, you need to, like, it's more than just having a home. You need to have nurturing, right, in order to grow.
Attunement, people who are actually listening to you, present for you.
Yeah.
Attending to you.
Yeah, mm-hmm. For sure. Mm-hmm. So, like, yeah, I mean, I definitely had to kind of get over this idea that I had developed inside of me that, like, and this is thankfully long ago now, that I had to, that I was worthy of love, and there wasn't anything intrinsically wrong with me that made all of that happen.
Right.
You know, and I spent years and years and years trying to get my parents to tell me why they got a divorce, and they would say, you know, it's actually none of your business. And I would say, you are incorrect by, like, galaxies. And they still won't tell me.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, it doesn't matter why they got a divorce. It just took me a long time to figure out that my creative voice was, like, was important. And I belong in this mix of people who are expressing their points of view in ways that aren't somehow profitable.
Mm-hmm. That you can belong in that tradition of,
right,
of creativity.
Without
regardless of whether there's a goal or whether it's lucrative.
Right. Yeah. Oh, you know, Becca, you're too old to ever get a record deal. Like, whatever. Like, hardly anybody gets a record deal. Like, what is this malarkey we're talking about? You know? I don't know. It's like the world is pretty rough for everyone right now. It's a pretty dark timeline we're on, and like we need things that give us joy and make us feel alive. And I don't just mean, like, feelings of happiness that are associated with, like, dopamine. I mean, like, these things that make us feel fully human and in touch with different parts of ourselves and connected in ways that are non-trivial. You know, we like the internet gives us a lot of pretty shallow connections, but we need to find ways to be present and less brittle.
Absolutely. Yeah. To fortify ourselves with life force, you know?
Yeah.
With libidinal energy, in a sense. With life force, you know?
It's getting very, very granola for me, and I'm feeling uncomfortable.
Oh, God! Oh, no! But you're totally making it happen, which is wonderful. I feel so warm and fuzzy that you're acknowledging this. First of all, I mean, we can get more real if you want to, in terms of the macro, you know, reasons that we're all depleted, you know, in this way. But I do like staying personal.
Yeah,
I'm sorry it's getting too touchy-feely for you, but
it's
beautiful because, and it's real. I mean, the thing that I'm thinking about is, we can get back to the evils of capitalism or whatever, but like, yes, there are more and more ways for us to spend our time and distract our minds and passively consume entertaining things. And we get joy from those things, but arguably a deeper joy is to be able to create rather than to just passively consume. If you're moved to create, it's important to tap into that and to create, because otherwise we are starving ourselves. We're neglecting ourselves.
Right.
When we don't create.
I am a big fan of, so, you know, there's this concept of tikkun olam in Judaism. Mm-hmm. And I'm a really big fan of that particular working metaphor where, you know, we're all cracked and a little bit broken, and it's our job to keep repairing ourselves, just as the world is cracked and broken, and it's also our job to keep repairing the world.
Mm-hmm.
Right? And
that both of these things are in concert. It's not one or the other. It's a harmony between repairing the world and repairing ourselves.
Always. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, yeah, mm-hmm. Yeah. This is fundamental Judaism. And so I think you know, these creative things, and like the other, like, it doesn't have to be visual arts or music. I mean, it can be something different for everybody. For some people, it's just the practice of, like, of healing, and that's their way of being creatively present. For other people, you know, reading is a creative pursuit, mm-hmm. because you're creating worlds that
you're engaging your mind.
You.
Yeah, so, absolutely.
You
true.
Know, I think,
true.
I think, you know, and I think a preoccupation with the arts is a sufficiently creative life. There's so much great work out there that you can immerse yourself in. Maybe you don't need to make your own, and that's okay. I think it can get judgmental very
yeah.
dangerously, but you know, my father-in-law, my father-in-law,
yeah.
who wants everything under control, once told me he doesn't like modern art.
Surprising
and
that
still,
abstract splatters on the canvas would be upsetting to
I
his
still don't understand
order,
what you mean.
His sense of order.
Do you mean, like, yeah, and but like modern art is such a vast,
yes, yeah,
vast concept,
mm-hmm.
and you know, I'm like, when do you know? I don't know off the cuff when modern art starts and ends, but like, I find this to be very problematic.
Uh-huh. Well, yeah, and it's a generalization that he probably couldn't even substantiate, because
right.
if you pointed out some modern art to him, he probably would say, "Oh, yeah, I kind of like that."
Right.
You know, so
right.
So what was he really, saying there? But also, I agree with you, and I want to just sort of reflect back on that idea that, yeah, I don't want to create a false dichotomy between passive and active or
right.
or consuming and creating,
yeah.
because like you were saying about tikkun olam, it's sort of like, you know, there's a synergy there, and anything that we do can be generative and creative, like
yeah.
I like we were talking about this earlier a tiny bit, like the art of cooking, you know,
yeah.
You know, like anything that you do in your life. So I'm obsessed with creative pursuit in my life. It doesn't necessarily have to look like
right.
visual art. It doesn't necessarily have to look like playing an instrument. It doesn't necessarily have to look like, you know, sculpture or whatever.
Yeah.
It can look like living my life creatively, for example. And that's where I have put a lot of my energy and time into in my life. I've spent a lot of time, now I'm in my mid-40s, I've spent a lot of time thinking that I haven't done much with my life, and I've been, you know, what's the word? I've failed to launch, you know, because I haven't really deeply pursued a career that feels sort of inherently meaningful to me. I have the shrapnel of a lot of dead careers in my wake that just sort of never got off the ground, etc. But in reality, I actually have lived my life very creatively in my engagements with people, in my interaction with people, like the way I do my relationship structures, the way that I can be present for people in my life. So there's so much to that. It, you know, being a creative person with a capital C does not have to look like, you know, you're gaining expertise in one of the traditional arts.
Right. And I think that's a really important point too. Like, there is a kind of shaming that happens starting very early on, where people's interests and preoccupations are placed in a hierarchy, right? So, like, at the top of the hierarchy is mathematics.
Right. I see where you're going. Uh-huh.
Right. And then, and this is, you know, and then we have, like, what would come after mathematics, probably sciences, right? And among the hard sciences, probably the lowest would be biology, right? and then we get into the soft sciences, right? Like
sociology, yeah,
mm-hmm. and anthropology and history, mm-hmm. and history is probably at the top of the heap there. And then in history, you even have a hierarchy. And then the arts come like you know, pretty far down. So I think when, you know, this is not healthy. It's not healthy to, when you're like,
the idea of like putting, valuing,
right,
in that way, valuing people's,
right, and
interests,
and when you know, when you're putting together a creative not a creative pursuit, what is the word that I'm looking for, when you decide that what you care about and what you want to spend time on is this creative thing, whether it's caregiving or music or, you know, crocheting or whatever.
And and by the same token, we can't look at technical skills like computing and things like that, stuff that happens to be at the top of the hierarchy in terms of the valuation, you know, the monetary valuation and the sort of respect culturally that we confer on it. Mm-hmm. We can't look at that as not creative, right? That's actually a creative process as well.
Yeah. I mean, I think what it comes down to in my mind, and I don't pretend to be an authority on anything, is sort of like the intention, right? Like, is this being done with the intention to make money? Or is this being done out of a sense of fulfillment and a desire to be present and, you know, real? Like that, is it engaging with capitalism or is it engaging in humanism? And like that's the difference for me, right? There's a very big difference between a pop star, you know, as much as I love like shitty pop music, and I really, really love shitty pop music. But I think there's a big difference between Taylor Swift, the pop star, and then you know, someone like I don't know, the Butchies, right, who are not doing anything to pursue commercial success except sort of putting their music out there. And, you know, they're a small indie band and they don't have a slick marketing team. And so, like, they're just different kinds of musical experiences. Taylor Swift is a marketing machine. Mm-hmm. And then there's these other people, you know, pick your indie band, like there's a ton of them, and they don't have the slick packaging and they're just making music, and they may not be good looking, and that's not relevant one way or the other.
Mm-hmm.
So I think it's you can take that same model for just about anything, right? It's hard for me to look at, say, Jeff Koons, who's an artist I particularly despise.
I don't know him.
Jeff Koons, I'll pull up a picture on my phone.
Just don't play a clip because I don't have, you know, licensing.
Yeah. And, you know, like, it's hard for me to look at Jeff Koons, who's considered art, and not think of it as just sort of like, it's a product. It's just a shitty product that's designed to be a status symbol. Here, Jeff Koons, he makes these giant metal...
Oh, yeah. I've come across his art before.
I don't think it's art.
Right. Right. That's what you're saying.
I mean,
that's how it's defined, technically.
Right.
I guess.
Yeah, it's technically art, but I don't think it's coming from a place...
It's very literally shiny and polished.
And expensive.
Yeah.
And it's a status symbol, and it's meant to be a status symbol, and it has a marketing sheen.
Mm-hmm.
So, like, I can't remember who said this, you know, someone said art is controversial or else it's propaganda.
Oh, I wonder who said that. That's a great...
I'm sure we can find out.
That's a great quote.
It is a click away.
Uh-huh. Should we do it? Should I look something
up? Look it up.
What was it?
Art is controversial or it's propaganda.
Dead air.
And I don't know if I 100% agree with that, but I think that part of that is making space for art that is not quote unquote.
I'm not finding it right now, but maybe I'll put it in the show notes.
Yeah. I think part of that is it, you know, it reminds me to make space for things that are not quote unquote good in the sense that, you know, they will not be.
They're not marketable.
Right.
Right. They're rough.
Mm-hmm. And they're not necessarily relatable. You know, if I were to write a song about how I'm lonely and always surrounded by gay men, that's not a terribly relatable situation, but it's real to
actually
me.
That's a major, at least subcultural trope. I don't know if it's an overarching cultural trope, but
is
yes
it?
Yeah. I think that's great. I love it. I think you should fucking do it.
I would worry about making them feel bad.
The gay men are fine. They'll be fine.
Likely true. But like I would not expect that to be a hit, and that would be coming from my heart. And
that example.
Well, I mean, this is why I'm starting that conference, and I'm also starting like a social group for bi and pan folks. I feel like a little island. A little tiny bisexual island floating in the big gay sea.
Mm-hmm. Right. Well, in the even bigger heterosexual sea as well, but yeah.
Yeah, I don't know that many of them.
I've heard that there are heterosexual people.
Yeah. They're kind of everywhere, but they don't really register. So
I think we've talked. We've had a conversation. It's awesome.
Good. Is there anything else that you can think of? I feel like my life is not terribly exciting.
No apologies for whether your life is exciting or not. Polished or not.
I am not polished. No one will say that I'm polished.
It's so great. No, I thank you so much for coming out here and spending time talking to me about the creative process. And thanks for going deep.
Sure.
I know we just scratched the surface, but we also...
Yeah, I don't think I went that deep, Like I was saying before, you know, I think it's important. I think we have these universal experiences, and I think it's really important that we can... talk about feeling insecure or vulnerable or fragile sometimes, because everybody does now and then, and if we're constantly trying to block that and show a good face even among our friends, then we're just sort of perpetuating this culture of gaslighting. Where we never get to feel whole. So even if you can't talk about it, at least you can sort of create about it and have that, have it validated so that you can, it's like condoing your experiences, right? You have to like acknowledge it and thank it before you can leave it.
Mm-hmm. Right. Right. And that may or may not have to do with showing it to an audience, airing it for an audience.
Oh yeah. I mean, performing is a whole different thing.
Yeah.
Yeah. I would
actually like exorcising it in the sense of like getting it out of you,
right,
putting it onto paper, putting it into notes or
whatever
form it takes. But
right.
Yeah. And then, you know, and that validation actually can come from that sense of having exercised the thing,
right,
regardless of whether any other human hears it, sees it.
Yeah, yeah, mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. Just being showing up for you.
Thanks for listening to my conversation with Becca. She's a writer, chronic overanalyzer, and community organizer who is doing her best. She's obsessed with The Good Place and stands for Elizabeth Warren. Also, Becca taught me the word stan, which means to be an overzealous or obsessive fan, so thanks, Becca, for teaching me a new word. We are And the Next Thing You Know. Find us at nextthingpodcast.com or subscribe at Apple Podcasts, Google Play, or wherever you do that thing. If you're liking the show so far, leave us a rating or a review at iTunes. It really helps us spread the word about the show. And if you want to support the show financially, find us at patreon.com/nextthingpod and throw us a few bucks a month. Join the conversation at Next Thing Pod on Facebook and find me at Sue's Next Thing on Instagram and Twitter. That's SOOZE Next Thing. Send us your own And the Next Thing You Know story, even if it's a tiny, subtle thing that shifted your life in a different direction. It's really easy to do. Just record a voice memo on your phone and email it to nextthingpod@gmail.com. We might use your story on a future episode. You can also just shoot me an email and say hi. Our beloved banana peel image is by Max Runnersco. Our theme song and interstitial music is by John Schwartz. Thanks, everybody. We'll talk soon. Unless I've been so successful decolonizing my time that time becomes a meaningless abstraction.